No, actually, I'll introduce because I want you to introduce everything else.
Okay, that's fine. Well, we are recording now, so.
Excellent. Fantastic. Hello, everybody, dear listeners. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable Board with the podcast. Oh, God, I've failed already.
What was that?
That was me stumbling over my own tongue, which I think, when you think about it, it's quite impressive. My name is Jazza. This is the Right Dishonourable podcast, and I do this podcast weekly with Jimmy.
Hello.
Hello, Jimmy.
I'm the other guy making cynical comments.
You're the other guy. I feel like you're the straight man to my flailing of hands.
I mean, I suppose that works in both senses, really.
Wow, well done. Yeah, I got that after about 3 seconds. For those listeners who don't know, I am gay and Jimmy is straight. La 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 la.
There you go.
The banter we provide, sterling as always.
I think we're probably slightly funnier when we're tired, but less well informed, if that's actually possible.
Well, so we're recording this at 9 o'clock, which, if we were young, sprightly things, would not be a late hour. But we are busy people with jobs.
Jobs are tough. Don't get them, is my advice.
Yeah, be a perpetual student as long as you can, people. Save yourselves.
Okay, so what topics are we doing in this wonderful podcast?
Sure. Well, we, on this podcast, in case this is your first time listening, we talk about social events, current topics and politics on a weekly basis. And this week, we're going to be talking, as always, about three of those things. Firstly, we're going to tackle the elections that just happened in the United Kingdom.
Yes. So the main elections from our point of view were the London elections, but they also had various local elections throughout England. And...
That's very London-centric. Don't make us worse than the rest of the media.
We're just as bad as the rest of the media in the sense. There are also elections in Scotland and Wales and even Northern Ireland, which we won't be talking about because we have no knowledge of that area.
DUP held?
Yeah.
There you go. Done the Northern Ireland elections. Well done, us.
And aside from the elections, we are going to be talking about... Should we do refugees second? I think we should do the... So there's been this ongoing furor about... whether or not the UK should take on 3,000 child refugees. I say children, but I get the impression they're mostly teenagers, which is...
I'm also children. I think you're a child until you hit 18.
No, you're a minor until you hit 18. We're going to have an argument about this later, but we have the word teenager because teenager is a period between adulthood and childhood. So
yeah, okay, we'll try and not go into semantics, shall we?
And yeah. The final topic that we're talking about is actually this scandal, I suppose, about schools being forced to convert into academies, which is less esoteric than it sounds because it's an argument about the privatisation of public services and how evil the Tories are, etc., etc. And those are going to be our three topics. Shall we begin, Jazza?
We shall. Last week, we saw the elections of the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh, London and Northern Irish assemblies and local council elections across England, as well as the police and crime commissioners, which hugely important. Really, everyone cares about them. And we also had a series of mayoral elections across the country, the largest of which being the election in London, where Labour's Sadiq Khan became the first Muslim mayor of a major Western city, apparently.
Are you excited for that, Jazza, given your previous stances on diversity?
Yeah, I think it's great. American media kind of lost its shit a little bit because they were like, oh my God, the London mayor won't be able to come to the US if Trump gets in as president. So that's going to be really quite fun. I think that... So we talked about this last week when we covered these very same elections before the results came in. And I think that the power of having a Western Muslim mayor of one of the greatest cities in the world is going to be really powerful because it shows that not all Muslims are loco, really. And I think that it really puts in a certain amount of it provides a certain amount of like humanism for the people who are like, oh yeah, Muslims shouldn't be allowed in the country. But when the Muslim is the mayor of bloody London, I think that it shows how ridiculous that is.
I don't know, because I think the sort of people that say the thing you just said tend not to be from London anyway. London's pretty distinct from the rest of the UK, demographically hugely so, but just in terms of attitudes and the way London kind of relates to the rest of the country. So
I may be pulling this stat out of my ass, which is very unlike us.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
But I think something like a quarter of Londoners are not born in the country.
I'm surprised it's that low, to be honest with you.
I think it's one in four, which I think is still quite high.
It's still pretty high, but I think it's one of the stats for me is that I think something like 60% of London is white, but something like 85% of the country overall is white. So that kind of gives you a little look at the racial diversity, I guess, of London.
Sadiq Khan trounced Zach Goldsmith, the Conservative.
Yeah, so he got like 57% of the vote, is that
right?
Yeah,
so he got 44% on the first ballot, Zach got 35% on the first ballot. And then on the second round, Sadiq got like 57 and Zach Goldsmith got 43. And mate, that's like a trouncing. That's basically a landslide, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, people have been saying that because we're going to see more devolution in future. I mean, Liverpool also had their elections for their mayor in the week just gone past, and they returned a Labour candidate, kind of unsurprisingly, given Liverpool's history. Bristol are having an election soon. Bristol just had an election, I should say.
Yeah, their independent mayor has been replaced by a Labour mayor, which is very good for Labour, good for them.
Yeah, but I think cities are more of an obvious constituency for Labour, so to that extent, I think Boris Johnson was something of an aberration. I think we're going to see mayoral offices in England are going to trend towards Labour, just because the sort of people who live in cities just share
urban
more
values areas tend to be more Labour focused. You see that on electoral maps all the time when you see the breakdown of each constituency. The UK always looks a lot more blue than it actually is, because Conservatives tend to do really well in rural areas where Labour tend to be focused in cities. So it's curious that mayors are going to be kind of forced down people's throats under this government, seeing as they aren't actually going to do particularly well in local government, we're assuming anyway.
Well, you should bear in mind that the Tories that are in charge of the Tory party, I'm talking about George Osborne, David Cameron and so on, are more from the urbanite kind of cosmopolitan wing of the Tory party. They're not like, I mean, I realise David Cameron is often described as a Shire Tory, but even he's quite modern as they go. He's not from the crazy reactionary wing of the Tory party, which is the one that tends to be represented in rural constituencies. So in that sense, it's not that surprising. I think it's going to be quite interesting going forward, because one of the things that you see a lot in American politics, where they have elections for everything pretty much, and they have so many layers of different government, is you get a lot
sometimes
of conflict between government
for judges, which terrifies me.
Yeah, I mean, that's a terrible idea for all sorts of reasons. But you get in Britain, we're going to get more and more power is going to be put onto the city level. And therefore, you're going to get a lot of cities that are run by Labour and potentially still have governments that are Tory, which I think is... There's the potential for some gridlock there, I think, and especially when you think about the devolutionary powers as well. We now have an incredibly complicated electoral system compared to what we have had, say, 20 years ago.
The Conservatives in London as well just didn't do particularly well. They lost a seat in the London Assembly, which... I'm not 100% sure what they do. They're meant to hold the mayor to account.
I actually do know what the London Assembly does.
Oh, go for it, you clever man.
The London Assembly is essentially a committee, in the sense that it kind of just, it's quote-unquote scrutinises the mayor's work, but they have very little power. They can like make recommendations about all of the issues the mayor deals with, so transport, housing and so on. But if the mayor doesn't like what they have to say, he's pretty much free to ignore them, except if there's a two-thirds majority in the assembly that votes against the mayor's budget, I believe that that is cancelled. That's pretty much the only real power they have. But the assembly's always been divided in such a way that that's never been a realistic prospect anyway. So
I don't think that's actually possible, because the Conservatives have 8 seats in a 25 seat London Assembly, and so you'd need, like, you wouldn't, I don't think you get a 2/3 majority, forgive my poor maths, if Labour, the Greens, UKIP and the Lib Dems all kind of ganged up together. They get 17.
Yeah, something
is
like that.
Who knows? But yeah, basically, the Conservatives lost a seat, the Lib Dems lost a seat, and UKIP gained two. They had no representation within the London Assembly before, and now they have two locos. I mean, perfectly normal elected officials.
It's interesting the fact that the Greens actually got, I think, 6% of the vote on the first round, which is quite a good result
for them. Yeah, Sean Berry.
Yeah.
They came third. This is their second time coming third in the mayoral election, which is quite...
And they got two seats on the Assembly as well, which is one more than the Lib Dems have. So yeah, the Greens do quite well in London, and the Lib Dems are getting trashed there now. But the Lib Dems didn't do so badly in the local elections. The damage was quite minimal, and I think I'm right in saying that they won a council. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're the only party to win a council, and I think by percentage they won more seats than anybody else. Which is a bit of a way of skewing it, because they didn't do particularly well in 2011 after they went into coalition. So really, the only way was up, just the same as in the general election in 2020. Basically, the Lib Dems just need to do better than 8 MPs, which they inevitably will do better. And what do you think, Sadiq Khan? I don't want us to spend too much time on Labour, on London. Mm. What do you think Sadiq Khan is going to be like as a mayor? Are you impressed by him, or is he a bit of quite a lot of hot air?
I suppose I should lay my cards on the table and say that I actually did vote for Goldsmith, despite his very questionable campaigning methods. Let me explain my reasoning. I know it's unfashionable to discuss policy in elections, but from my point of view, I actually did read the manifestos, which is also, I think, something that's unfashionable to do. And it seems to me that the policy, like the headline policies for all four of the major candidates, I didn't read the UKIP one because I was never going to vote for him. All their headline policies were roughly the same, like we're going to build more houses, invest more in transport, yada, yada, yada. It seemed to me the only real difference between Khan and Goldsmith policy-wise was that Khan put more of an emphasis on things like rent controls and fare freezes, so more like socialist methods to actually, or social democratic methods, of controlling the price of something to try and keep it down. It seemed to me that Goldsmith was more on the side of easing up regulation. So there was a lot more emphasis on planning in Goldsmith's housing, the detail of his housing manifesto policy and policies. And there was also the concern about with the fare freeze for Khan. Goldsmith wasn't advocating for that. And I think somebody has to pay for the transport system at some point, and getting money is going to be a problem for Khan, because he has to work with the Chancellor, because London has very limited tax raising powers. So from my point of view, I'm assuming you vote for Khan, but I thought the policies of Goldsmith for me were slightly better, even though there wasn't a great deal to choose between them.
So I put Sean Berry as my first choice, just because I quite like it when the Greens come third, because there was no chance of her winning, obviously.
Yeah.
And then I did put Sadiq as my second choice, because I don't... although policy-wise, I probably agree with Zach Goldsmith quite a lot, I'm not going to reward a campaign that was as venomous as his, whether he intended it or not. It would really worry me if a campaign that was that fearful did well in British politics, and a campaign based around like racial identity did well, because that's not really traditionally how British elections are run. And I think that it was something that was maybe adopted from more of an American model, where your racial profile says more about how you're going to vote than the rest of your attributes. And so I think that I voted for Sadiq as a symbol more than anything, and as a way of punishing the Goldsmith campaign, because, like you said, there wasn't a huge amount of difference between them policy-wise.
I kind of voted for Goldsmith knowing that Khan would win, which I suppose if the vote had been closer, maybe my calculation would have been different. I'm not sure. But yeah, I went into the polling booth knowing that Khan would win because his lead in the polls was just so phenomenal that there was no way it was going to turn out any way different, even if the polls had got it significantly wrong. Just an interesting note, the pollsters actually pretty much got most of the elections that they did polls for. They got them correct. They got the London result correct. They got the Scottish results correct. And I think some of them overshot on the local elections. Like there were some predictions that Labour were going to lose loads of seats, and in the event I think they only lost 30 council seats. Is that correct?
Yeah, but didn't that have more? I think they lost 11, actually. It was even less.
It was less than that.
Yeah, I think so. And in terms of like the council elections, this is also a round of local council elections in England that Labour should have held on to. Just because of the councils that were actually up for election, they should have been very Labour strong. So a loss of 11, it's not great. They did a lot better than people were initially expecting, but it wasn't fantastic. What's quite significant is that Labour have just been completely destroyed in Scotland. They lost 13 seats. They now only have 24 seats in the Scottish Parliament.
And they came third to the Tories as well. Tories are now the official opposition in Scotland.
The official opposition, which is great for Ruth Davidson. She fought a fantastic campaign. I would love to see more of her and Nicola sounding off at each other because they are fantastic personalities. It's very entertaining. It's probably not the best way of measuring like the political capital that somebody should have. But Ruth Davidson is a superstar north of the border, as is Nicola Sturgeon. And it really kind of has highlighted the lack of superstars in Westminster, I think, which is quite depressing.
I think there's a sense of opportunity about Scottish politics that there isn't really in Westminster. But I think maybe because of the independence referendum.
Do you think it's because of the, and also perhaps because of the election system as well, do you think?
Are you talking about the fact that it's a proportional representation?
Yeah, it's a form of PR. So basically, there is a first round of voting which is by constituent, and then there are like the party lists which top up a certain number of Scottish members of Parliament. We should also say that the SNP, despite the fact that they did really, really well, they lost six seats and lost their majority.
They lost seats, but they got more votes because of a quirk of the electoral system.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's weird in itself. So they no longer have a majority, but they actually did. They had the best result in the Scottish Parliament that they've ever had, in the sense they got the most votes. But in the sense that they lost seats, obviously, they are somewhat in decline, or you could read it that way. I mean, what do you have any thoughts about? Have we reached peak SNP? I guess is the obvious question.
Yeah,
you should
be
asking.
Yeah, I think we have. I think that we have. But that in itself is ground shattering. Labour used to be by far like they'd never used to have to campaign in Scotland because Labour was a sure thing north of the border, and this is what happens when you're complacent about your electorate and you refuse to provide one way or another a decision on a single question issue like Scottish independence. Labour have been treading a line of, oh, maybe, maybe not, oh, I'm not sure if we'd want another referendum, perhaps, oh, I don't know. Whereas the Conservative, everybody who wants independence is now voting SNP. And have moved away from Labour, and everybody who wants to keep Scotland within the United Kingdom has now gone over to the Tories, essentially, I feel, is what's happened.
I think there's people voting SNP who don't actually want independence, who just like the general progressive mandate, which is kind of phony because the way SNP has governed in Scotland has been far more centrist than you would necessarily think from listening to their rhetoric.
Yeah. But they've won three elections in Scotland in a row now. They're on, practically unstoppable. They have lost their majority, so they're going to have to work with other parties, most likely the Greens, who themselves won four seats to become the fourth largest party, leapfrogging the Lib Dems, who stayed on five. Sad Lib Dems. But the SNP should be able to govern reasonably easy with a what's the phrase called? A supply and confidence?
Yes, yeah.
Or something along those lines. With supply. The Greens, with the Lib Dems, with certain members of the Conservatives or Labour. They served, obviously, famously in a coalition with the Conservatives in 2006, I believe.
I don't know if it was a coalition, but the Conservatives definitely supported them in a lot of votes. So I think it was a tit-for-tat kind of deal.
Can we talk briefly about Wales as well? Labour, I believe, they lost a seat. They didn't have a majority before, and we're back kind of in the same... Not a huge amount changed, to be completely honest. Lib Dems lost a load of seats.
UKIP won two seats, is that right?
UKIP won seven seats.
I do apologise.
They had no seats, and now they have seven seats.
So
ridiculous.
The reason I said two seats is because there were two relatively high-level figures in UKIP who won seats for them. One of them is Mark Reckless, who is the Tory MP who switched sides, then had an election and was re-elected as an MP on the UKIP ticket, but then lost his seat at the general election shortly afterwards.
He's a weird one. He looks like an overgrown Teletubby.
He's made some odd career decisions, shall we say.
Yeah.
Speaking of odd career decisions, the other guy is Neil Hamilton, who was famously caught up in the Cash for Questions scandal, which is to say that he took money to ask questions in Parliament on behalf of his clients, I suppose you could say. So he sort of offered a personalised lobbying service and then was famously disgraced and chucked out of office.
Interestingly, we were talking previously about hitting peak SNP in Scotland. It looks like we've hit about peak Plaid Cymru, who are the Welsh nationalists as well, who seem to be hovering around like 12, 13 seats in the parliament and not really making any headway with that. It looks like in the past they've worked with Labour, but then been punished in the polls afterwards, in the same way that it happened to the Lib Dems when they went into coalition with the Conservatives in Westminster. But it looks like, I feel like there's only so much kind of appetite for Plaid Cymru nationalism, to be honest. What do you think of Welsh nationalism as like a political force?
It's quite strange, isn't it? Because the Welsh nationalism for some reason has never been as strong a political force, certainly like post World War II, as Scottish nationalism. And when they actually Labour brought in the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Assembly around the same time, I think it was sort of 98-99. And they held referenda on whether to form these assemblies, and the Welsh one only just skipped past like the 50% mark. So it could very well have gone the other way, and Wales could still be sort of fully rolled into the English would not have its own parliament, basically. Obviously, they still send MPs to Westminster, but I don't really understand why it isn't such a force, because it seems to me that they should have all the same complaints about Westminster that the Scots have. So
I've been to Wales in the run up to the UK wide elections, in the general election, and because I feel like a lot of people in Wales aren't Welsh or don't have Welsh a Welsh background, a lot of Plaid Cymru's USP is based around the Welsh language as well, which itself can sometimes be dividing and alienating for Welsh people who don't speak Welsh.
They do actually teach Welsh in schools pretty widely now, don't they?
They do now, yeah. But obviously people in schools, they don't vote. But I think that there is a fear of Welsh nationalism as like something that's quite nasty and quite divisive, that doesn't sit quite so well in Wales as it does in Scotland. And I'm not saying that Scottish nationalism was always nasty, but I think that there's more of a tradition of getting riled up in the pub with people that you disagree with politically, whereas I'm not sure that that particularly is a strong part of Welsh character. That's just kind of like the impression that I get of the country.
Well, Scotland has more of a civic nationalism kind of vibe. So there are there's various ethnic minority communities scattered around Scotland through some of the Windrush migration, and I'm trying to think of the community in Glasgow.
There's loads of Italians. There's loads of a huge Indian and Pakistani population there.
Yeah.
As well. Whereas Wales is pretty damn white.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I'm sure there's someone who could give us a halfway sensible answer to why that is.
But, note to self: have more guests. Shall we wrap this up?
I think we've covered all the personal points.
Oh, wait. Northern Ireland, nothing much changed. There you go. Okay, we're done now.
That's great. One of these days, we will actually cover Northern Ireland properly, but not today.
No, very good.
So in recent weeks in the House of Commons, there's been a series of furious debates about whether Britain should take on more child refugees from the Syrian crisis. A couple of days ago, this was actually defeated in Parliament, much to condemnation from figures in the media and opponents of the government. But more recently, David Cameron has done a kind of semi-reversal of his previous stance and made a very mealy-mouthed commitment to actually taking on some refugees, although, as is implied by what I just said, we don't really know very much, many of the details about this. It's thought that there are about 90,000 child refugees scattered throughout Europe who've come into the continent through different means and different places, and there are concerns that they're being potentially abused, that some of them are having to turn to even things like prostitution to actually make money and feed themselves, and they're obviously in a very vulnerable position at the moment, which is why the British government has been condemned. Jazza, what's your sense of this scandal? Why do you think that the Tories have opposed it, and why do you think they've changed their minds?
Is it a scandal? I'm not sure it's a scandal. I think it's them trying to maintain a certain amount of toughness on immigration. I think they read it particularly wrong on this.
You think they read the public mood wrong?
Well, because even the Daily Mail jumped on the bandwagon and started saying that the government should take child refugees, and I think that really tipped it, to be honest. But we've seen like a lot of outpouring of kind of like anger towards the government for not stepping up and doing this. Loads of really powerful comparisons with like the Kinder transport in Germany. And it is a really difficult line for the government to justify, essentially. What I worry about is the fact that I think they are now going to take a certain number of refugees, but I think that they're going to take, in the similar way that we did with Syrian refugees in general, we're going to take way below the number that is going to be significant in alleviating the stress on other countries, and significantly below what our capacity would be, which really annoys me. Like, you can play that at least we're doing something gig, but I yet again am kind of underwhelmed by our government's attitude towards what's happening in Syria, to be honest.
The thing that confuses me slightly is that the government originally cleaved to this line that we won't take kids from Europe, but we will support kids in Syrian refugee camps closer to and refugee camps just outside of Syria, where the chaos is ongoing. I don't understand why it's felt to be incumbent on the British to actually do something about this, and I don't understand why such a furore is being made when they're already in European countries that are relatively safe, if you put it that way. I don't see why the burden hasn't fallen on the, say, Italian government, where some of the children are, or just any of the other national governments that they're staying in at the moment.
So I just came back from an event by Save the Children, actually. They just launched a video campaign called Still the Most Shocking Second a Day video, mm-hmm. Which is basically based around as if an English girl is ends up living as a refugee and having to flee to France because of war in the UK. And it's really, really shocking and like brought tears to my eyes. You should definitely check it out, dear listener, if you have a chance. And what they were telling us is that even when kids are like within like the Balkan states, and when they are in Greece and have managed to get out of Syria, they once they are separated from their families are not out of the woods yet. Sometimes quite literally people get lost when they're trying to cross borders. They will be when they're in the custody of like people traffickers, they will have guns pointed to their head, they will be traumatized. We got really obviously this is coming from Save the Children, and so they have a desire for us to like understand like really harrowing things that happen. This of course is not the case for all children, but there are children who they were talking about when they have like the safe spaces that they create, especially for young people, and some of the games that they play that deal around drawing and stuff, there were descriptions of some of the things that were being drawn coming out of like a horror movie. And so just being in Europe does not guarantee that a child is safe yet. Especially when they are separated from the rest of their family. And I think that I'm under the impression that it isn't just the UK that needs to do this. It's other developed European nations that need to step up and make sure that these kids are cared for and not like trudging through like Serbian forests and whatever else they have to go through. And so there is kind of like there. I did see the Prime Minister making that argument that these children are in European countries; they're safe now.
Well, my impression was that the countries I heard named were more like Italy. Greece was obviously mentioned as one, being at the brunt of the refugee crisis, but also France as well, which kind of baffled me.
I don't know too much about the kids who are there, but certainly those that are already in Europe. But I'm thinking of like the Macedonians and the Serbians and the Greeces. The safety of those children is definitely in jeopardy.
Well, I mean, apart from anything else, a country like Greece doesn't have the money to, fund a decent social security service at this point, yeah, even for their own people, let alone foreigners coming into the country. So, yeah, I certainly understand it from that point of view. Why do you think the government's totally misread this? And it seems like, bearing in mind that they were asked only to take in 3,000, I don't know why 3,000 was chosen as a number, it's quite an easy win for them PR wise, do you not think?
Yeah, which is why I was so kind of frustrated and annoyed. What is the thinking behind that? I think that they are still scared of the way that a public that is about to vote on its status as a member of the European Union, they're still scared of the effect that taking in refugees is going to make on that on that vote. And so I think that the idea was that they were going to try and hold it off until after June the 23rd. But that, like we said, even the Daily Mail like came around in the end. And when the Daily Mail advocates like taking in refugees, you know that the situation has gotten pretty damn dire.
So if it's just a misread of the situation, and the do you think the decision was always going to be reversed sort of after an EU referendum then? Do you think that was always the game plan?
Yeah, I think so. And then Cameron was going to be the saviour, bloody blah, blah.
But as it stands, actually, the referendum could very well go the other way, although I suppose then the refugee children would probably be the least of Cameron's problems at that point.
Yeah, then we'll be under Prime Minister Boris. And then God help us all as we all flee the country.
There have been some reports on a kind of more general basis that the flow of refugees into Europe has actually diminished, partly because of the Turkish deal that Angela Merkel has struck with the Turkish Prime Minister. Certainly, like, the general levels of interest in the migrant crisis have also gone down. Do you think that Where do you think we are at this point?
Is that not because we've just come off of quite a harsh winter? And so that reduced the mobility of a lot of migrants who are coming through Europe. And also we've had a much stricter border enforcement across the Balkan like corridor, which like because of Schengen and open borders within certain members of the EU, it was very easy for people literally to walk from it's not called Constantinople anymore, is it? From
Istanbul.
From Istanbul. all the way up to the town hall in Munich, and that got shut off very quickly. And so the flood, which is a horrible way of putting it, of people has subsided into more of a trickle because movement isn't as easy. I'm under the impression that that is going to increase again over the summer because then weather is less likely to stop you from being able to move. So I think that we are at a pause at the moment rather than a complete stop.
Well, they've put in place measures to actually deport people from, say, travelling between Turkey and Greece. If you arrive in Greece and you've gone there illegally, you will be deported back to Turkey now. But the situation does also seem to be quite fragile, diplomatically speaking. There's some prospective deal in place to give Turks sort of visa-free travel into Europe, which is potentially beneficial for things like tourism. But there's also a feeling that there's going to be problems actually getting that through the European apparatus, just because there's certain countries that are
How do you feel about this deal with Turkey? Because I'm in two minds about it. I think that it's like it's an idea. I don't think it's probably the best thing we could have come up with.
I don't really. So there's a lot of things that are just massively troubling about the way the Turkish government is operating. We actually discussed doing a topic around the crackdown on journalists.
We did that topic, I believe.
Did we do
that? Oh, no, we did it about the German comedian.
Yes, we did. I mean, there's also been that whole scuffle. But there's been a total failure to have a pan-European response to the migrant crisis. And I think that just speaks to the weakness of the EU as an institution. I mean, irrespective of whether or not you're in favour of the EU strengthening and whether or not you're in favour of Britain remaining in the EU, there are some serious governance problems within the bloc. So, and this has shown those up, I suppose. But I think Merkel's done actually quite a good job considering all the constraints she's been put under and the lack of help from a lot of other European leaders who haven't exactly covered themselves in glory throughout this whole crisis. No easy answers, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Shall we wrap this segment up?
Yeah, why can't we all get along, guys?
Around the time of the last budget, George Osborne announced in what many people found a curious thing for a chancellor to say, that all of the schools in England and Wales would be converted into academies, which basically means that they no longer answer to local governments, they answer to central government, by which I mean the Department for Education. This has been very controversial in teaching circles partly because a lot of the teaching unions are rabidly left-wing and they dislike any sniff of privatisation in their school
system. If you're
system.
A teacher, please don't switch off yet.
I feel I can say that. My sister's a teacher and she's confirmed a lot of the bad rumours about teaching unions. But there's also very sketchy evidence that academisation, as it were, actually helps improve school results. In fact, depending on who you ask, the evidence is either bad or at best mixed, it's unclear at the moment.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but academies, if they used to be really good schools, then they continue to be really good schools as academies.
Yeah, so you can
if an
you
academy
can convert
as previously bad, then it continues to be bad, right?
Yeah, so you basically if you're a good school, you can choose to become a converter academy, which means that instead of answering to local, you just answer to central government, and there's some funding changes that go along with that. And as Jazza said, if you're at the lower end, if you're a bad school and the government forces you to actually convert into an academy, you tend to still continue to do badly. There's some exceptions to that rule. But there are some success stories, there are some very bad stories, but I'm not really sure why it is the government is pushing this through, to be honest, because the evidence, at least from my angle, my cursory level of research, seems to be that it's a very flimsy case to make that this is a good idea.
Is it because of the idea, the ideological reason of competition, and the idea that competition breeds like excellence, basically? It means that schools are essentially going to have to compete for parents to want to send their kids to them.
Yeah, that's probably the simplest explanation. I guess me and you probably don't share that particular preconception about how the world works with the Tories.
Well, I do kind of understand. Like, I understand where it would be good. And where academies do work is where there is a lot of choice for schools for people to go to. But where there is just one school within a catchment area and people have very little choice as to where their kids can go, then an academy system isn't going to work. That's where you need there to be, like, a benchmark, a boy from central government that makes sure that it doesn't drop under a certain standard. Whereas if an academy doesn't have to worry about kids being taken out of their school and put into another, which is what happens when a lot of these failing schools get turned into academies, then the whole idea of competition goes out of the window because there isn't any, which just seems obvious and loco to me that they want this to be such. This was a flagship thing, a flagship policy announced by the Chancellor, nonetheless, not even the Education Secretary, Nicky Morgan. And it just feels crazy that this is something that they want to push so hard.
So we should, I don't get it, mate. We should say, I don't think I did say in the intro, but they've recently rowed back on forcing this change through. They say that they still want academies. They still want all the schools in England and Wales to turn into academies. I think Scotland has a separate education system and is actually run from the Scottish Parliament now.
Everyone moved to Edinburgh.
They want this to happen, but they're not going to force it through. So they're just going to kind of wait for it to happen of its own accord, I suppose.
Yeah, they previously had a timetable of, I think, was it 2022? I believe.
Something like that, yeah.
For all schools in England and Wales to be turned into academies. And that goal has now been scrapped, but they still want to have it on the roadmap, as we say in corporate speak. This should be terrible for the government, right? Why are they not, like, riling in self-loathing the fact that they've had to do a 360 on this? Because traditionally, this would be prime material for an opposition to, like, lay into the government. But, oh, wait, no, Labour's run by Jeremy Corbyn. Oh, I forgot. No, he just reads emails, doesn't he?
There was actually, this is on a slight tangent, but John McDonnell was angry with something that Caroline Flint said in the wake of the elections, and instead of emailing her and sorting it out internally, he actually decided to tweet her with his complaint so that every journalist in the Westminster lobby could actually see the internal wrangling that was going on. It was something incredibly petty as well. That is slightly unrelated, but it does speak to the lack of media management, I suppose, within the Labour Party at the moment.
Media management? What? There's no management. There is no leadership. And it's frustrating as hell because this government, of all, like, they don't get projections right. They've done, like, half a dozen U-turns since the beginning of this blooming year, for Christ's sake. And they're still sitting pretty on the top of their Eurosceptic hill. It's very annoying. And I'm not like an anti-Tory. I think that Tories actually sometimes do really good stuff. But you need somebody to hold the government's feet to the fire to make sure that they're doing a good job. And Labour aren't able to provide that. As the main opposition, they can't do it. And it's frustrating when I want to have, like, an alternate voice provided to the electorate, and there isn't one.
So do you think...
I'll get off. Shall I get off my soapbox now? I'm done.
Well, don't say you're done right now. I don't need to ask you questions. Do you think it's ideologically Corbyn is about as different from David Cameron? I think it's possible to get in the British context. Maybe if Cameron was a bit more racist, then you'd have like slightly more gap between the two of them. But, or maybe not, as the case may be. Do you think this is just a lack of like political skill? Is that what this is about?
What Corbyn not being able to call the government up on this? Yeah, to a certain extent. But also the fact that Labour are currently focused on ripping themselves apart. So I think that's actually the main thing to do about it, because Corbyn at the moment, I was about to say, is trying to hold his party together. Is he even trying?
It seems like there's... I don't know why we're just talking about Labour now, but there's a cabal of hard leftists within Labour. I suppose you could say the Tories are run by hard Thatcherites if you want a bit of balance there, but they've taken control of the party, but there's still people left over who disagree with the basic prejudices of the hard left, and that's why you get breakdowns like the whole anti-Semitism row from last week that we spoke about. But actually, like, to be fair to Labour, the Tories are actually doing quite a good job of attacking themselves over various things as well, aren't they?
I mean, Europe being the main thing, right?
Yeah, Europe certainly being the main thing. But also, as you say, like, this, the Academy thing is one of a series of pretty major blunders that would normally be very, very embarrassing for a government, but... it doesn't seem like they've faced that much criticism. I mean, the Academy's thing, even though we are talking about it now, doesn't seem to have got a huge amount of coverage. I mean, it's been covered on most of the websites, but it doesn't feel like it's led the news agenda in the way that it should have done.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I find it quite frustrating that UK media has gotten quite Americanized in that it's being very one... issue focused. At the moment, the US media is it's fixated, talks about nothing else other than the presidential election. It's 6 months away, for goodness sake. But there's no other stories. There's nothing about the policies that Obama is still putting through. There's nothing even about what the Senate is going to be doing about the replacement of the Supreme Court judge that needs to be replaced. And we're kind of doing a similar thing in the UK when it comes to the European referendum, because that seems to dominate, not so much as it does in... it's not as big as problems in the US, but it seems to dominate so much of the media kind of, in old speak, column inches, that it means that we aren't able to have DMCs about the policies that the government is putting through, because it doesn't survive a single media cycle.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty much all true, but I think we will probably go back to the Academy thing at some point, because I think the Tories are obviously still very attached to this policy, and therefore in future policy announcements they will again refocus on turning you know, regular schools into academies. And hopefully at that point, Labour will be in a slightly better position to actually counter them, because it does seem like it's not that great an idea.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Now that we've both depressed ourselves, should we wrap this whole
thing up? But you've got me very annoyed, Jimmy. Why have you got to do that? That wasn't very nice of you. Grumble, grumble.
If you enjoyed this very tired podcast, you can find us on rightdishonourable.com. I can be found at JDE Nichols. You can find Jazza at Jazza John.
And you can find The Right Dishonourable at Right Dishonour. Tweet us, we like it when you do that. Finally, also very important in this, dear listener, please, I implore you to go to iTunes, to leave us 5 stars, and to review us with your typing words.
You suddenly perked up an awful lot when it came to the self-promotion. That's very professional of you.
Mate, I'm a YouTuber. It's second nature to me now. I can't leave a room without asking somebody to like, comment and subscribe.
On that bombshell, should we end the show?
Yeah, let's end it. Bye-bye, toodaloo.
Bye-bye.